people singing Pumped Up Kicks, a great song. I've always liked it. And believe it or not, the first place I heard it, I guess close to about 10 years ago now, was on the nationally syndicated radio show of our next guest. And that should not come as a surprise, because while that might not immediately strike you as his type of music, it's the kind of show where you always discover something new. A new film, a new song, a new idea, a new way of looking at politics, a new book. And he's somebody who I have learned a lot from in terms of how to do this craft of talk radio. He's somebody who is a brilliant guy. He's somebody who, even when I end up disagreeing with him, I can't argue with the logical functionality of how he reached all of his arguments. And he's the kind of voice, as far as I'm concerned, that we don't hear enough of on the radio these days, and a former colleague of mine, and he's somebody that I am thrilled has agreed to stay up late and chat with us a bit. I am really, really pleased to be able to be joined by nationally syndicated radio talk show host, author, film critic, you name it, he's done it all, Michael Medved. Michael, thanks so much for staying up late with me on the radio.
Hey, what a pleasure and what an honor and what an incredibly gracious introduction. Thank you very much.
So, Michael, we have not had an opportunity to speak since Rush Limbaugh passed away. Rush, of course, was a staple at this radio station for 25 years or so. I first learned about you when you filled in for Rush Limbaugh on the radio. I think you did at least a couple of dozen times. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about Rush's influence, not only on this medium of talk radio, especially political talk radio, but what he kind of meant and what filling in for him on his show meant for your own career.
Well, everything. I mean, there would be no talk radio medium without Rush. And the one thing about Rush is that is so different from so many people who reach a celebrityhood of that status, of that stature, is that Rush was actually, as you probably know, an even better guy, a nicer guy than he appeared on the radio. I mean, that whole thing about being bombastic and talent on loan from God and one half of my brain tied behind my back just to make it fair, that kind of thing. He was not an arrogant person. He was not an egotist. He was somebody who was actually kind, who got along with people, which not everybody in our business does.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, to me, it's very, very striking, is that there was a best-selling book 100 years ago, literally 100 years ago, called Theodore Roosevelt, A Hero to His Valet, which was written by James Amos, who was a longtime valet to President Roosevelt, who heard the last words of Theodore Roosevelt, which were Mr. Amos. He called James Amos, Mr. Amos, please turn out the light. In any event, the point was that Theodore Roosevelt apparently said, you can tell the measure of a man by how he treats people who really can't do anything for him, who basically where he's not trying to get something back in return. He's just a decent human being. That was Rush. Rush had the same very loyal, very devoted associates like James Golden, Bo Snerdly, who I'm sure you know well.
Yeah, he's actually doing a show on our station now, Saturday mornings, 8 to 10. He sounds great, actually.
Oh, James is great. And again, I think it's very important. I did not particularly in the last couple of years agree with everything that Rush said. But it was always entertaining, it was always substantive, it was always thought-provoking, and I think the essential decency of the guy came through.
Well, no, that's nice to hear. And you have led so many different careers. You've been a best-selling author, and I want to ask you about your most recent book, God's Hand on America.
Thank you. You've
been very successful on the radio, but you've also been a film critic from time to time. You were the chief film critic for the New York Post for several years. I'm curious, now that we're just a couple of weeks away from the Oscars and a lot of folks like me are trying to catch up on all these Oscar-nominated films, is there anything that's been nominated this year that you particularly like or don't like, or you'd characterize as a must-see for folks that haven't yet done so?
There are a bunch of them that are awfully good this year. This is a very strong Oscar year. And for those people who want to obsess with the idea that America is crippled by systemic racism, this is very likely to become the first year in which all of the acting awards, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Actor, Best Actress, all four of them are going to go to people of color. And that's the way the SAG awards were given out. Mm-hmm. And it's largely the same voting group, because most of the members of the Academy are the actors branch. And they all vote also in the Screen Actors Guild Awards, the SAG Awards. And the SAG Awards went to Daniel Kaluuya for Judas and the Black Messiah. And he got Best Supporting Actor. Best Actor went to Chadwick Boseman. He should rest in peace, from Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Best Actress to Viola Davis, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And Best Actress was for that lady, Young-Yun Yuan, who is an elderly Korean actress who was just marvelous in Minari.
She is terrific in that film. She's very funny.
And that's one of those films everybody should see. It's a shockingly pro-American movie, and I love that about it. It's about a Korean immigrant family struggling to raise vegetables in deepest Arkansas. And all of a sudden, the people you meet in deepest Arkansas, particularly including the church-going, very devoted Christian people, are nice. They're actually kind, as by the way, I think is the case for most people in America. And it's a lovely film and very touching and beautifully done. And by the way, I think a very good chance of winning Best Picture.
Really? Oh, that would be something. So do you think that with all the leading contenders in so many of these categories being minority actors, do you think this is sort of the Academy's way of trying to make up for previous criticism that they were racist, essentially, or a way for them to, for Hollywood to make up for the perceived societal ills that plague America in terms of race and social justice and things of that sort?
Okay, I'm going to say something that's terribly politically incorrect, but that's my job.
Wonderful. Great. Counting on it.
I never bought this idea of Hollywood so white. I don't think that people in the past were discriminated against. I think that there were a couple of years there simply weren't a great number of great black performances and great black films. This year is different because all of these major films, including One Night in Miami and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Judas and the Black Messiah, and three of the five nominees for Best Supporting Actor are black males. And look, it's not compensatory. It's not because they're trying to persuade people we're not racist. It's because these guys were great. They deserved it. And actually, I do think that though Hollywood makes lots of contortions and ties itself into pretzels to avoid implications of homophobia or racism or disableism or anything else, when it comes to the Oscars, they do tend to nominate and then give the awards to people who actually deserve it. And I think that's very much the case this year. I can't think of any of these that are sort of being handed out as, oh, well, this will show we're not racist. No, these were great performances. Did you see Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
I did. I liked it very much. And, first of all, the music alone, I thought, was worth seeing it for. And then the performance from Chadwick Boseman was very strong. There were other films this year that I've seen that I liked more than that, but I thought it was an enjoyable film. I liked it a lot.
You know, the big film that nobody saw and got no Oscar attention except for special effects, that I think was one of the best movies of the year, was Greyhound.
You know, so I started that, and right now I'm an hour into it. I'm hoping to see the conclusion of it today. But Tom Hanks is terrific in it.
He is, and he co-wrote it, and he co-produced it. And he's also in another great film this year, Tom Hanks, which is News of the World, which is nominated on a couple of minor, but Tom Hanks could have gotten a Best Actor's nomination for that one too. But Greyhound is a great story of World War II. It's based upon a true story. It's based upon a novel by C.S. Forrester, who wrote all those great Horatio Hornblower books. And it's about a convoy and a U.S. ships right after America came into the war escorting British ships to get to England and trying to deal with the wolf pack under the ocean of the Nazi submarines. And it's a thrilling film. And for people who are at all interested, as I very much am, in the history of naval warfare, it's a remarkable achievement.
Now, that's good. You're interested in a wide variety of history, and you've actually been present for some key aspects of 20th century American history. If I remember correctly, I think you actually worked on Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign back in 1968. How, now, for folks that that have a tough time reconciling the conservative radio talk show host Michael Medved with the perceived populist liberal presidential candidate of Robert Kennedy. Can you tell folks a little bit about your journey from Democrat to Republican?
Sure. And by the way, I don't think Robert Kennedy would be accepted by today's woke Democrats at all. Because he was very much an American patriot. The whole idea of American guilt or American apologetics, that would not have been something that Robert Kennedy would have put forward. I wrote a book called Right Turns, which was basically how I was transformed from a punk liberal activist into a lovable conservative curmudgeon. And it actually, the process involved three factors, which I think tend to make almost everybody more conservative as they get older. One is paychecks, one is parenthood, and one is prayer. And paychecks, I remember when I actually started earning money shortly after I graduated from college, and I started getting checks, and I started noticing, wait a minute, I was supposed to be getting X, and it wasn't much. And here the government's taking all this out. And all of a sudden you become a little bit more concerned. Taxation is no longer an abstraction. And then parenthood, I had wanted kids for a long time. And when my wife and I got married, and I was in my early 30s, and we had kids, all of a sudden you view everything differently. And partially, and I write about this in my book, because the human life issue, before we had this wonderful baby, our daughter Sarah now, we had a miscarriage. And the miscarriage was fairly far along, 5 months, and it was horrible. And all of a sudden, when you go through something like that, you look at the human life issue very differently. You know, it's no longer a choice. This is a baby you lost, and then the idea of being a parent and having to see a long-term horizon, I think, is very, very much impels people toward conservatism. And then prayer, finally, it was actually, I was in my mid-20s when I became religiously observant and started observing Shabbat, started observing the Sabbath, and started putting on tefillin, saying prayers in the morning, every morning, and I have now since I was 22. All of that, of course, also gives you a longer-term perspective, which I think is the great gift of religious faith, is you're no longer focused on, oh, let's see what happens after the next commercial. You're actually even thinking about the next world.
So we've covered your journey, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Michael Medved. You can check him out online hear his show if you're in a market that doesn't get it, which unfortunately New York currently is, at michaelmedved.com. There's show highlights on there. There's podcasts. It's a terrific website, michaelmedved.com. We've covered your journey from Democrat to Republican or conservative, lovable conservative curmudgeon. let's talk about where you fit within the conservative movement these days. It seems like over the last 6 years, not just the Trump era, but the Trump era seems to be the greatest tipping point. You are sort of out of fashion with where the mainstream of the conservative movement or the Republican Party is these days. Is that something that you agree with? Do you feel that the conservative movement and or the GOP has changed in an un-Medved-like direction?
Yes. To not put too fine a point in it, yes, and absolutely, and it's a shame. President Reagan, who is still my political hero, used to say, I'm a conservative, but I'm not angry about it. The idea that anger is a winning political strategy is nonsense. That's a populist idea. That's not a conservative idea. And by the way, if you're born in the United States of America, all four of my grandparents are immigrants. My mother was an immigrant. My mother escaped Germany in 1934 when she was 9 years old. And look, if you are lucky enough to be born in America, that's a golden ticket. You are part of the luckiest nation, the luckiest breed of people, the luckiest generation ever. And the idea that the imperfections in this society or some mistakes that we make or some things that are embarrassing or things that are lacking, that should get you enraged and to talk about our government as collapsing in America. Oh, one of the things that I despise, frankly, about politics on both sides is the notion of apocalypticism, the idea that if we don't win this election, America's through. I remember people saying that in 2016. Well, if Hillary wins this election, that's the end of America. That'll be the last election we ever had. There's a colleague that you and I have on talk radio who would say that all the time. If Hillary wins this election, that will be the last election we ever had. Look, the Democrats won this time. Trump won last time. I don't think either one is the end of the republic. We are a strong nation. My most recent two books are both about divine providence and providing a path and a strength for America. And I think you can see that in events all around us. And part of what God's Hand on America does is it takes a look at, since the Civil War, is God still protecting this country? And I think there's so many events and developments that I describe in the book that give a very strong answer of yes.
So the book is called, and again, if people want to check it out, they can get it at michaelmedved.com or
on it. Released this week in paperback.
Oh, terrific. God's Hand on America, Divine Providence in the Modern Era. What inspired you to write this book? You've written about a lot of different subjects, politics, history, movies, and religiosity before. Why write God's Hand on America?
Because when you actually look at it and you go back to the era of the Pilgrims and the Puritans and the Revolutionary Founders and the Constitutional Generation and of Abraham Lincoln, and right through our history, our greatest, most significant leaders have believed that America wasn't an accident, that there was a purpose to all of the good fortune, to all of the blessings that we had attained. And basically, I see a country right now that is obsessed with guilt rather than gratitude. And gratitude is a very much more productive emotion to feel than guilt, especially for a country like ours that is so greatly enriched and redeemed the entire world. And this is something that Abraham Lincoln believed. It's something Franklin Roosevelt believed. It's even something that at the end of his administration, you heard little glimmers of it from Barack Obama, of all people. And I think the notion that America has been a great, exploiting, horrible, wretched country. America's been an imperfect country like every other place. But the point that I make in God's Hand on America is not that America's had special protection, special blessings as a reward because we're so good. It's because we're so useful. It's because, look, if you assume that there is such a thing as a fate, nature, a divine guidance in history, If God is going to do anything like that for humankind, he's not going to rely on Belgium. he's not going to count on Paraguay. It's going to be the biggest kid on the block, the most substantial country. Walter McDougall, who wrote a terrific three-volume history of the United States, he used to teach at University of Pennsylvania, said it very well, is without any question at all the most substantial development of the last 500 years of U.S. history has been the rise of the United States, and nothing else close to the influence or impact of that miraculous rise, and that's what I write about.
Two final questions I have to ask you, Michael, and then I promise I'll let you get to bed. One is, you, at least once a year, maybe twice a year on your show, you would devote a whole edition of your show to conspiracies, inviting people to call in, talk about conspiracies and conspiracy theories. You are usually pretty cynical of these. I'm curious, in all your time doing this on the radio, and, you know, look, the late night radio audience does have a soft spot for conspiracy theories now and again. In all your time doing this on the radio, was there ever a conspiracy theorist or a caller touting a certain conspiracy theory that ever convinced you?
No, but at least that raised some questions. Convince me, no, because most conspiracies, particularly the ones like QAnon, would be an example of complete insanity and degraded insanity. But the one that I think does raise some serious questions is TWA Flight 800. Mm. And there are questions about that. There were eyewitnesses who saw flashes of light that may have been some kind of ground-to-air missile as the flight was taking off. And I think there are some real unanswered questions there. On balance, I think it's probably the official story, the idea that there was some kind of engine failure. I think that's probably true, but at least there are legitimate grounds to question some of those details.
And finally, Michael, when I was promoting your appearance over the last few days, a few listeners wrote to me and said, that Michael Medved, he's a creationist. He doesn't believe in evolution. Can you set the record straight for the cynics in our audience? Do you believe in evolution, or do you believe in intelligent design, and are the two mutually exclusive?
Of course they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, evolution only makes sense if you believe in intelligent design. And again, do I believe that evolution is a reality and that it took place and that it helped to shape the emergence of ultimately human beings? I do. But do I believe that this is entirely random or it's a purely natural selection? What's fascinating to me is I'm very involved with this because I'm a senior fellow at Discovery Institute, which is the leading source for intelligent design information. I had a guy named Frank Keating, who was a Nobel Prize level physicist at University of California, San Diego, who also believes, in other words, the point is, the best argument that I know of for intelligent design is the idea of irreducible complexity. Because, for instance, how do you, an eye is such a complex mechanism, and very basic forms of life do not have eyes. So how does an eye develop? Because if you develop a retina without a lens, it does you no good. If you have no optic nerve and you have a retina and a lens, okay, it does you no good. You don't get an evolutionary advantage until this very carefully designed eye or ear somehow develops. And to say that, oh, yes, people who have that one nerve that is going to need to be completed by another nerve are going to have any evolutionary advantage from that, it's a foolishness. The DNA evidence, there's a very good book that I would heartily recommend. I've had the author on many times on my show. He's a friend, Dr. Steve Meyer, who's a Cambridge-educated philosophy of science, a PhD from Cambridge University. And the book is called The Return of the God Hypothesis.
Michael, on that note, on that book recommendation, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. But I do hope we can chat again maybe in a few weeks and continue the discussion.
Anytime. It's a real pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. Michael Medved, 800-848-9222. Straight ahead.